Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the Columbus Metropolitan Library has a lot going on, including some activities aimed at helping Columbus residents educate themselves before going to the polls for the November election. We'll learn more about that, and we'll hear from the YWCA of Columbus about a new leadership program that's about to begin. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, the Columbus Metropolitan Library is partnering with the Franklin County Board of Elections to increase voter awareness and engagement. We are under 90 days now from the big election in November. And anywhere you can find resources to help educate you on the different issues that are at hand. And that's why we're joined today by Ben Zanitsky. He is a media specialist for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And he's going to talk with us about the opportunities they have for voters to become more aware, as well as some other great things that are happening at the library. Hi, Ben. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Wow, it is. I don't know how you'd miss it, but of course, it is election season, and your library system has really gone above and beyond this time. So you are offering resources and different opportunities for voters to learn more about the issues that we're voting on. And what a great idea. Tell me more about how this came to be.
Absolutely. You know, at Columbus Metropolitan Library, we are so much more than books. We are all about sharing resources and connecting people. And so, you know, what better place to come for more information about the upcoming election than your local library? Our staff at all 23 of our locations are ready and waiting to help you either get registered to vote or check your existing registration or make sure you know that the polling place that you'll be going to on election day. In addition, if you've been reading or hearing anything about Ohio Issue 1 and it confuses you, don't worry, you're not alone. We will actually be hosting a panel discussion at our main library on Thursday, October 10th, discussing Issue 1, what it would do and what it means. So mark your calendars. We hope to see you at our main library on October 10th. In the meantime, you can learn more about these and all voter resources that we offer at our website, columbuslibrary.org. And if you scroll to the footer at the bottom, you'll see a link to our voter resources page, and you can get connected with all kinds of resources to help you ahead of the election.
And that voter registration deadline is fast approaching. So what a great opportunity while you're at the library checking out some books or other materials to get yourself registered to vote if you aren't already. What a wonderful resource. Not that we didn't know this before, but the Columbus Metropolitan Library just keeps on giving, and we're so appreciative of that, Ben. Past Election Day, or outside of the election stuff, there's still always a lot happening at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Recently, it was announced a partnership was formed between the Children's Hunger Alliance and the Columbus Metropolitan Library to help make sure that kids aren't going hungry. Ben, can you share a little bit more about this initiative?
Sure. This is a partnership that we have been fortunate enough to have for a number of years now, where we are partnering with Children's Hunger Alliance, as you said, to offer free after-school snacks to kids ages 18 and under. At this year, it is 16 of our 23 library locations. And you can see which locations offer the snacks and which times they offer them on our website, columbuslibrary.org. If you check out our events page, I believe there's even an after-school snack checkbox under event type. So you can see when and where these snacks are offered. But, you know, in addition to after-school snacks, we have so many great programs for the students in your family. We really want to be your students' after-school destination. We have programs and resources for students of all ages, and of course, they'll have access to our entire catalog and staff who are eager to point them in the right direction. We have our after-school help centers, which provide support for K through 12 students. At all of our locations, we have Reading Buddies, which offers one-on-one reading practice for K through 3 students. We also have a number of programs throughout our library system for teens where they can get creative and explore all kinds of different technology, from green screens to sound booths and recording equipment. So you can learn more and, of course, see what's happening at the location nearest you at columbuslibrary.org.
Now, Ben, some of these programs you're talking about sound pretty advanced. Is there a fee to be involved in these? Do you have to pay to be a part of them?
You do not have to pay. These programs are all free. Many of them, you don't even need a library card. But if you're in our locations, it's a great opportunity to get a library card. If you don't already have one, we always like to say it's the most valuable card in your wallet.
It really is, and especially because you don't send me a statement with a bill every month. So I really
That's
appreciate
right.
that. Ben Zanitsky is a media specialist for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. He just shared with us a wealth of knowledge about after-school programs that are available free of charge to students at the K through 12 level. You named the grade. The Columbus Metropolitan Library has a program for your students after school, in addition to, at some locations, snacks for kids after school, thanks to a partnership with the Children's Hunger Alliance. A lot is happening. Now, also in the news recently, we heard about your current CEO's announcement of his retirement. And then quickly after that, we heard about your new CEO. Ben, what can you share with us about the new library leader that's coming in?
That's right, Kate. Our CEO of the past 22 years, Pat Lisinski, announced his retirement this spring. And we announced the hiring of his replacement. And she is our current CFO. Her name is Lauren Hagen. She's been with us here at the library since 2018 and really knows this organization very well. She'll begin in this new role on October 1st. So we're grateful for Pat's leadership over the last 2+ decades, and we wish him all the very best in his next endeavors.
Absolutely. What an exciting time for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. I know, I think we last spoke, or I last spoke to someone from the library about your book festival, which was a smashing success a few months ago. And it seems like there's always something happening, obviously, at one of the Columbus Metropolitan Library branches. So I cannot urge folks enough to explore, find their local branch, get to know their librarian, and take advantage of some of these wonderful resources in our community. Ben, is there anything else coming up on the calendar that you would like us to know about?
We have something for everyone, like you said, Kate. And if you have not been to your nearest library location in a long time, do yourself a favor. Stop in. I think you will be surprised that the library you remember is not the library that you are walking into. So you will be, I think, blown away, especially at some of our newer branches that we have renovated or rebuilt over the last several years. We're in the process of rebuilding a number of other branches as well. We're building a new Linden branch, a new Barnett branch, new Canal Winchester branch, a new Marion Franklin branch. So we are always reinvesting in our communities with new state-of-the-art, iconic 21st century libraries. So stop in and see us.
I can't think of a better invitation than that one. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Ben, and always great to hear about what's happening at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. We're joined today by Christian Johnson. She is the program manager of the Leadership and Social Justice Department at the YWCA Columbus. She is also program manager of the Kathy Duffy ESPE Leadership for Social Change Program. Applications are now open for the 2025 program, and Christian is here to tell us so much more. Hi, Christian.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, as the Leadership for Social Change Program Manager, I would imagine that you can answer any and all questions regarding this program. So let's start off by discussing what exactly the program does.
Sure. So the leadership for the full name is the Kathy Duffy Epsi Leadership for Social Change. And essentially, it is for women who find themselves in the early part of their careers. So we typically take 21 to 39-year-olds, and they just want to develop and build upon their leadership skills and want to learn more on how to be change agents within their community.
And how long does the program last?
Sure. So the program is 11 months. So right now, as you mentioned, we're taking applications. The cohort will officially start in February of 2025 and will go to December of 2025.
And about how many applicants are you, or I guess participants, are you looking for from the field of applicants?
Yeah, we take 25 applicants every year. So we have been grateful to have had a plethora of people just sign up and put in their applications over the years. But we do take 25 of the strongest candidates or applicants.
It sounds like a really kind of a no-brainer for a woman in her profession who's looking for kind of that next step to level up, but to also really make an impact in the community. Through the course of this program, has the YWCA of Columbus seen kind of how that ripple effect happens once someone goes through the program and then goes out to actually affect social change?
Absolutely. So the beautiful part about our program is every month there's a different topic. It can be anywhere from how to network for social change, how to fundraise, how to become a political activist, how to be a community organizer. So within all of these different sessions, the participants are just gaining tools on how to use them in their everyday life. And one of the beautiful parts is still being tapped into our LSE alum and hearing how they're making change within their community, whether that is running for office, whether that is they use the skills in one of the sessions to, let's just say, it's authentic leadership session to strengthen their leadership skills, to advocate for themselves for raises or new jobs, or really rallying behind a social justice issue and cultivating a culture within their community where they are someone who is seen as like a reliable or resource for maybe questions they may have, or a safe space for just kind of understanding some of the language behind social justice issue. So it always warms our heart to hear what our alumni are doing in the community, whether that is their, school, whether it's their work community or the community at large, just kind of understanding how what was taught in the session still resonate with them.
Talking today with Christian Johnson. She is the program manager for the YWCA of Columbus's Kathy Duffy Espy Leadership for Social Change program. They're now accepting applications and they're looking for young professional women, approximately ages 21 to 39, who are kind of getting started in their career and their leadership journey and really want to be involved in the Columbus community to affect some positive change. 25 participants will be selected for this program that begins in February, and it takes 11 months to go through it with workshops and different activities. What a great opportunity. Tell us, Christian, how does application begin? Where does one go to begin this process?
Sure. So if you go to our website, www.ywcacolumbus.org, you will be able to find not only a fact sheet, so just a more robust information on what the program entails and how to be involved. And then right below the fact sheet is the application.
Excellent. And what is the deadline to get that application in?
Sure. The deadline this year is October 11th by 11:59 p.m.
Excellent. Okay. And when we talk about these 11 months of this program, I know we touched on it briefly, but what kind of a time commitment over that 11-month period could an applicant expect?
Yeah, so we meet once a month, once a month every Thursday, for about 2.5 hours. In addition to that, we do have additional opportunities for the participants to be involved in what we call cohort connections, and that just allows us to not only offer workshops to the current cohort but past alumni. So just some opportunities for them to network with alumni. There's a few group projects that they will be responsible for within the program. So I would say if I was to average the monthly time commitment, I would say about 4 to 5 hours per month.
That's not much at all, and for such a valuable experience, I feel like that's no time at all. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's really great.
Now, what else have we not touched on about the Leadership for Social Change program?
Other than it just being an amazing opportunity to network with women who are like-minded and just the ability to be connected with the robust YWCA network that we have, it is an opportunity to for the participants to just grow and learn more about themselves. There is the time commitment, there is the small financial commitment, but the as you mentioned, Kate, the reward for the program, excuse me, and the return on investment far surpasses what we may see as the time or money commitment.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to note also that on your fact sheet for the program, it's noted that women who are cisgender, transgender, and gender expansive are all welcome to apply for this program and to be a part of it. And that type of inclusion, I think, is really important to note in this day and age.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So, what would you have to say to someone that's maybe considering getting involved in this program, but they're just not sure yet?
It's one of my favorite questions, because my first response is always, if you think you should apply, apply. Women so often talk themselves out of wonderful opportunities to advance or to grow. And a lot of times, if you have that unction, if you have that desire to be a part of such a program, then just do it. Not only will it boost your self-esteem with completing a task that you feel as though you will benefit from, but the rewards of actually being accepted into the program will far surpass that momentary moment you may have of trepidation. So I just say apply. If you have any questions at all, please don't hesitate to email me. But my strongest word of advice is if you feel as though this is a great program for you, just do
Just do it. Absolutely.
it.
Christian Johnson, Leadership and Social Justice Department Program Manager at the YWCA Columbus and Program Manager of the Kathy Duffy ESPE Leadership for Social Change Program. Thank you so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kate.
And don't forget that deadline to apply for the program is on October 11th. Go to ywcacolumbus.org and look for Leadership for Social Change under their Social Justice tab.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
From navigating a large influx of Haitian immigrants in recent years to now debunking false claims about migrants harming pets, the city of Springfield is facing several challenges. But the biggest is keeping everyone safe. Schools, hospitals, and city buildings are facing threats, and the state is pouring in resources to help. Thanks for joining us for Face the State. I'm Doug Petcash. We made the one-hour drive west to Springfield to get answers about how they're keeping people safe. That's why I sat down here at City Hall with the man overseeing the state efforts, Ohio Department of Public Safety Director Andy Wilson. Director, you've been here for several days now. How would you describe the situation today here in Springfield?
Well, today, again, you can feel the temperature coming down a little bit. Obviously, it was frenetic. There was a lot of rhetoric. There still are a lot of those issues. But we've been able to surge in a lot of our public safety resources. You saw we put troopers at the school. We've brought in people to help with bomb sweeps. So we are doing a lot of work in that space, which I think is addressing some of the concerns of the folks who live here with respect to their safety. Everybody, when the rhetoric kind of ramped up, everybody was really concerned about the safety of the people who live here, who work here, and who visit here. So we wanted to make sure that we address that. As we address that, again, it feels like we're kind of starting to get back to what the real issues are with respect to the situation.
And you mentioned the troopers. I believe we have 36 at the 18 different schools doing sweeps, extra patrols. We see the watchtower outside City Hall. Has it made a difference in the few days that has been set up?
So right before I came to this interview, I was at a school with the governor. And the number one thing, the first thing that was that came out of that principal's mouth, the governor asked, he said, "Hey, how are things going? How are you doing?" And that principal said, "We are doing much better now." He said, "Since these troopers have been here, my staff, my students, the families who send their kids to school here, everybody feels better." And I get these stories again and again from those troopers being out front of, you know, parents pulling up, pulling down their window, slowing down the drop-off lines a little bit, just to thank the troopers for being there, for helping to keep the staff and the students safe. And I'm from Springfield. You know, I know a lot of folks who are teachers. I've been getting texts and calls of people who are just so thankful and so appreciative of what the governor has done with respect to keeping the schools and really everything safe. It's not just the troopers. We have surged in over the weekend. We've surged in. We really did a full court press from the Department of Public Safety. So we have folks from the Office of Homeland Security who are here, BMV Investigations who are here, the Ohio Investigative Unit folks are here. We've got, again, bomb-sniffing dog teams from the State Fire Marshal, the ATF. Everybody has kind of come together to work as a team to keep everybody safe. And I got to tell you, the men and women of the Springfield Police Division should should be applauded. They are stretched so thin. They have their regular job of just keeping people safe on the streets, responding to calls, and fighting crime in the city. And now their resources have been stretched even more thin with the public safety.
I was going to ask you, how strained are the local resources?
They are very strained. So again, we are in here. We're not the state police. We're the state highway patrol. And all of the assets we've brought to bear here in Springfield have been at the request of the city manager, the city public safety director, in the city police department. They need to, again, respond to calls. They need to keep people safe just in their normal course of duties. So they said, "Look, we just don't have enough people." So we've leveraged the sheriff's office. We've leveraged neighboring jurisdictions. So it's a full court press.
What are you focusing on, you know, these day-to-day trips to Springfield? What are you focusing on?
So the number one thing that we have been focusing on is the public safety aspect. So making sure that our buildings, that our facilities, that our schools, that our businesses are safe, and then making sure that people understand and feel safe, because those are two things that have to be addressed. You can make a building safe, but if people still don't feel safe going into that building, then they're not going to go, or they're going to be scared, or there's going to be anxiety attached to that. So it's twofold. It's making people safe, and then, again, getting the messaging out that you are safe. Now, in addition to that, we've been addressing the other issues, the real issues. Again, there's nobody eating pets here. There's none of that rhetoric. But there are real issues associated with this immigration issue here. It has put an incredible strain on the local government. It's put incredible strain on the hospitals. There are issues that you've heard the governor talk about again and again that we have to address. From a public safety point of view, other than, you know, again, keeping people safe in the immediate sense of with respect to everything that's going on, look, the Haitians who have come here, They're not criminals. They're not violent criminals. It's not, you know, the Venezuelans who have come across. I was at the border last year. You know, the Venezuelans who have come into communities, they a lot of the Venezuelan folks are actually security threats. They come from a gang. They came from the prisons. They came across the border into our communities. That's not what you have here. The Haitian community that's here, they're not criminals. And if you ask, you know, that we haven't seen a spike in crime since the Haitians came to Springfield. But from a public safety point of view, what you do see is they're just not good drivers. They're not good drivers. There's been a lot of crashes. Obviously, there was the tragic fatal crash. But that actually, we haven't had a lot of fatalities with respect to the Haitian drivers. That was kind of an anomaly. But you have seen a lot of fender benders. You've seen a lot of property damage in those crashes. And, you know, we have to address that. Everybody agrees that both the Haitian drivers and the citizens of Springfield, people who are driving through Springfield, we need to be safe on our roads. So we're looking at that. We're looking at how we can better train the Haitian drivers, the people who are getting licenses, how we can better train them to be good drivers. And if you look at it, again, the governor said this multiple times, if you look at, they come from a country where very few people have cars, and those who do have cars have no driver's training at all. And not only that, but they come from a country where there's really not driving rules. It's pretty much anything goes.
The city received at least 33 different bomb threats, according to the governor. Do you have any more information on, you know, where those are coming from?
So, yes, but, you know, I'm not going to tell you. We're working with the FBI, and we're just not going to tell you what countries those are coming from. It's an ongoing investigation that's being handled by the FBI. It's been more than 33 now, and that seems to be what we've been dealing with. And what we've tried to do using our resources from the Office of Homeland Security, from the State Highway Patrol, from the rest of public safety, working, again, with local officials as well, we're trying to develop a response, again, with the FBI and the ATF, where when we see the threat come in, we recognize where it's coming from, and we're able to triage that threat, at the same time taking every threat serious and responding quickly so that we don't have a disruption in services. So the reason, again, I've seen this in other crises. The reason bad foreign actors do this is they sit over in their country and they watch for communities where there are struggles. And they look for little pressure points to sow discord, to create disruptions in services, and that's what you're seeing. So what we need to do is we need to develop a response that's fast and reflexive, or flexible in a way that minimizes the disruption of services. So again, you saw the governor do it. The schools were getting bombarded, so we put the troopers in. We have these room clearing teams. We have these bomb sniffing dogs that are now going out and proactively searching areas. We have these Homeland Security towers. I'll give you an example. This happened earlier in the week. We have a Homeland Security tower on a piece of infrastructure. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but a piece of critical infrastructure, and it's watching. We got a bomb threat, you know, in the morning. That, hey, I placed a bomb at this place, and we know right away because we have that camera on it all night. Nobody came in and placed a bomb. It was clear the day before. So we're being very flexible. We're using all of our resources to minimize the disruption in services and minimize the discord that these bad actors, bad foreign actors, are trying to sow.
Former President Trump said he's planning to come to Springfield. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you've heard the governor say multiple times it is campaign season. The candidates have the right and really kind of the obligation to campaign wherever they want to campaign, wherever they think they need to campaign. Part of the campaign is discussing legitimate issues that are part of whatever their platform is. Clearly, the border and the issues at the border are an issue that need to be vetted through this campaign process. And clearly, again, you're seeing what happens when there are problems with your border issue. You're seeing it right here in Clark County. So clearly, any candidate can come talk about whatever they want. Now, that being said, keep in mind, like, we're stretched pretty thin here right now. From a pure public safety, our number one mission is to keep the people in this community safe. And the Springfield Police Division, they're stretched thin. The Clark County Sheriff's Office, they're stretched thin. The State Highway Patrol, we have so many assets in here. Like, we are getting to capacity. We're starting to beg and borrow from other agencies. So anything that happens will put a strain on those resources. That being said, we will adjust. That's what we do.
Now, he was one of the ones that was perpetuating the false claims about the migrants here. Do you think it would be a better idea for him to stay away?
Look, again, I'll tell you what the same thing the governor said. Anybody can come, any candidate can come campaign on any issue that they think is important. And immigration is an issue that at the federal level that they need to debate. They need to debate what the issues really are with respect to the truth about immigration, the problems that they're causing. So yes, I mean the candidates are free to come and that's the great thing about America. That's the great thing about America. You come and put your issues out in the marketplace of ideas and let them be debated however you can debate them. It will be a strain. It'll be a strain on the community, but it's not an impossible strain for us to overcome from a public safety point of view.
Mayor Rue just issued a proclamation in light of the threats directed towards city employees and residents, basically gives the mayor some temporary powers to basically cut red tape and be able to acquire resources faster. How helpful do you see that being in this overall effort as things play out?
Right. And when you have a crisis going on or you have an issue that you have to address in your community, anything you can do to make the response more efficient is a good thing. That's why I'm here. The governor understands in these situations the value of having a cabinet member on the ground, shoulder to shoulder with the local officials, kind of working through what those issues are. There's a couple benefits to that. Number one, it cuts down on inefficiencies. It allows everybody to communicate the same way with each other. We don't have to play the telephone game. I'm in the room with the mayor. I'm in the room with the police chief as they're talking about these different issues. So it increases the efficiency in which we communicate. And it also, again, the governor understands that having a cabinet member on the ground allows us to more quickly bring resources to bear. And again, that's probably what you see in Mayor Rue's proclamation. It's important to be able to be very responsive. And if you get jammed up in red tape or you can't address an issue that needs immediate addressing, that becomes a problem. So again, there's a lot of benefits to kind of removing some of that red tape, to working together to efficiently address these issues, again, for the folks who live in the community.
How long will the state be here?
You know, I we're going to be here. This is going to be a long-term problem. So there's short-term issues that we have to take a look at. There are medium-range issues that we need to resolve. And ultimately, there are some long-term solutions that I think you'll see the governor to put into the community. So I can't give you a timeline, but if you've seen anything out of Governor DeWine, when he's committed to an area or when he's committed to an issue, he sees it through, and he'll make sure that we're here addressing the issues, working with the locals to address their issues until the situation is resolved.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
When coaches don't play by the rules, we call it cheating.
In the Michigan sign-stealing scandal, Jim Harbaugh can't coach in the game.
When politicians do it, it's called gerrymandering.
The first political ads over Issue 1 are now hitting TV screens across Ohio. It comes as ballots are now going out with military and overseas absentee voting getting underway. And those ballots did not have finalized language for Issue 1. That's because of a lawsuit filed against the Ohio Ballot Board by the group behind Issue 1. They claim the language was biased and misleading in an attempt to sway voters at the ballot box. The Ohio Supreme Court ruled two changes were needed to the language, but now some are saying the updated language is still misleading.
We didn't get it right the first time. That's why there was a lawsuit.
State Senator Paula Hicks Hudson is one of two Democrats on the state ballot board who objected to the ballot language the Republican majority ultimately approved. Citizens Not Politicians collected more than 500,000 valid voter signatures to get the measure on the ballot. They say it aims to end political gerrymandering in the state's map drawing system. They and their supporters take issue with the approved ballot language that says the new commission would be required to gerrymander the legislative and congressional district lines.
Now, this was done, and it was created for the main purpose of hoodwinking the voters.
Republican State Senator Teresa Gavarone said the Supreme Court found the language accurately describes the amendment.
To say that this misleads people is simply untrue.
The amendment would replace the current redistricting commission made up of 7 elected leaders with a 15-member citizen commission made up of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 independents. No politicians or lobbyists could serve on the commission.
What's really important to note is that the substance of this amendment is not affected by the disingenuous attempt by politicians to rig the election on issue one.
While Democrats pushed for more changes to the language, Secretary of State Frank LaRose said time is of the essence.
The next 48 hours, we will actually be in violation of federal law, subjecting ourselves to a DOJ lawsuit, et cetera, and that's not something that we can risk.
After that ballot board meeting, Secretary LaRose and the other Republicans on the board did not meet with reporters to answer questions. Military and overseas absentee ballots are now rolling out, and early voting for everyone else in Ohio starts October 8th. Plus, don't forget the deadline to register to vote is October 7th. Then Election Day is November 5th.
I've been driving trucks for a long time. Safety is my number one priority. I know that my truck has huge blind spots. That's why I remember to check my mirrors often for smaller vehicles. Everyone can help keep our roads safe. Next time you're behind the wheel, try to avoid lingering in those blind spots. It can be dangerous. Let's all plan to share the road safely. Learn how at www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
It's no secret our community is growing at a fast pace, but now Central Ohio leaders are scrambling to make sure Columbus doesn't fall victim to the same mistakes seen in other so-called boom towns. So 10TV's Angela Ann flew 1,200 miles to Austin, Texas. Here's why.
Austin and Columbus, both state capitals with rivers running through them. Both similar in population size and booming with development. They have Dell and Samsung. We have Intel, Microsoft, Amazon, and more.
The transformation here in the last quarter century has been, it's jaw-dropping.
The comparison today to Austin is no mistake. In fact, it's been on the radar for Columbus leaders for decades.
The diversity of the economy. About 20 years ago, our community leaders took a trip. We went to Austin, Texas. We wanted to meet with the executives from Dell. We wanted to see what it was to have a tech-based community.
But since then, Austin city leaders admittedly made some errors.
I do think that if we had been able to get to the place we are at today with home and the changes to the land development code, if we had been able to do that 5 to 8 years ago, we would be ahead of the game.
10TV's recent trip to Austin uncovered ways Central Ohio leaders can avoid the same pitfalls. But some people here say we're already there.
We're building currently probably about half as much housing every year as we need just to keep pace with our growth.
Boomtown on 10TV also found solutions where cities around Austin are making sure they don't get swallowed up by that growth.
I'm not sure what Columbus has, but a lot of our water and wastewater piping is ancient. So rooftops can't pay for those improvements. We have to get industry in here to pay for those improvements.
Each idea, each decision, critical from Austin to Columbus to stay ahead of the boom.
Could conceivably become the largest economic development in the history of the United States.
And we have Angela Ann joining us now in studio this morning to tell us more about Boomtown and what she's uncovered. So, Angela, what is your biggest takeaway?
I think the one thing we heard was don't ignore it. It's going to come. You can't stop the growth, so embrace it. And a lot of city leaders in Austin said, if you have that attitude and mentality, then you can plan ahead as the growth comes, as opposed to planning with it while it's there.
You know, a big question that some smaller towns or smaller cities might have is, how do you keep the charm as this explosive growth happens? What did you find out about the secret to that?
A lot of secrets. It was kind of neat, though, because, you know, you think about our towns here. We have so many cities and towns that the charm is what people love, right? The small mom and pop stores and just all the things that make each town so unique. So down there, one town, Taylor, Texas, they're dealing with Samsung, building something much like Intel. And what they're doing is they're making sure that they reinvest back in some of those older buildings, the downtown areas. If they need a refresher on the facade of their building, the city will invest in that rather than putting that onus on the small business owners because they're already dealing with so much. So that is just some of the ways that they're keeping that small town charm. And also walkability. That is so huge when it comes to being able to just talk to your neighbors as you walk from the coffee shop to the florist to the little pocket boutique hotel down the street. And that walkability is something that we're seeing from town to town in keeping that charm.
So what is going to be the overall focus of Boomtown that we are going to be doing these stories and looking into this issue over the coming weeks and months?
Well, we know that we're already facing a lot of challenges here in Central Ohio. Housing is such a huge issue, and it's a fact. We are already behind when it comes to building enough affordable housing. So that is one aspect that not only are we looking at what other cities did to combat that, but what are the solutions? What are our city leaders and county leaders and state leaders doing to make sure that people, one, aren't getting priced out of where they want to live, families aren't having to combine household incomes just to survive, and then what can we do to make sure that as new people come in, that we're building the housing appropriately. And what that means is changing zoning laws. We saw Columbus do that. And it allows the city to build more dense housing in smaller areas.
And we're hearing from a whole vast array of voices throughout Boomtown as well.
It's exciting.
Angela, thank you so much. And that'll do it for us today. Thank you so much for joining me this week for Face the State. I'm Doug Petcash. We will see you back here next Sunday at 11:30. Have a great day.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.